send it to me, too.
Okay.
Thanks. Good morning, everyone. We're going to get started. I'm going to go ahead and call the Senate Committee on Judiciary to order. Thank you all very much for being here. We have a number of bills that are set for a public hearing and possible work session. What we're going to do, I know we have a couple of members here to testify on 2206, so we'll open up a public hearing on House Bill 2206.
Senator Brzezinski and members of the committee, House Bill 2206 comes to us from Representatives Taylor and Representatives Huffman. It renames the crime of patronizing a prostitute to commercial sexual solicitation. There's no revenue and no fiscal impact, and came out of the House chamber with a 9-0 unanimous vote.
Out of the House chamber with what type of vote?
9-0 unanimous vote.
That might be out of committee.
Or out of committee, excuse me.
Okay, I'm going
committee
say,
the nine. Thank you.
We've kind of consolidated the districts. We're down to 9-0
yes.
representatives. Love it. And we have two of them here right now. Yeah, John and Kathleen, why don't y'all come forward?
Mr. Chair. It was a slow day in the House, Mr. Chair.
We don't believe in say, quorums at all.
Yeah, what's this constitutional level now? We only need nine.
We've changed a few rules over there. So, well, thank you, Chair Brzezinski and members of the committee. I'm State Representative Kathleen Taylor from Southeast Portland, Milwaukee, Oak Grove. Thank you for hearing House Bill 2206 today, which renames the crime of patronizing a prostitute to commercial sexual solicitation. This is just one of several bills dealing with sex trafficking that will be coming before you this session. I want to thank Representative Huffman and other members of the Commercial Sexual Exploitation of Children Work Group for developing this bill. House Bill 2206 is very simple. It changes the name of the crime, again, from patronizing a prostitute to commercial sexual solicitation. Why is this change necessary? Because language matters. The name of a crime needs to focus on the criminal action under scrutiny. The current name of the statute labels the victims of solicitation as prostitutes, stigmatizing the woman involved. These are women who may be victims of human trafficking. Many have been sexually abused or forced into sex trafficking as children. Some are still minors. These women should be treated with compassion, not derogatory labels. Some victims are not engaged in the sex trade at all, but merely waiting at a bus stop or walking down the street. House Bill 2206 shifts the focus back to the criminal conduct of the accused without labeling or further disparaging the victim. It comes to you from the House with a unanimous aye vote. I urge you to support House Bill 2206 and move it to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Thank you.
Chair Brzezinski, committee members, Rep. Taylor did a great job. Oh, I'm John Huffman, House District 59. Thanks for having us. Rep. Taylor did a great job of teeing this up. We've got Laura and Joel and some others probably that will testify on this. But when Representative Tomei said that she was going to retire and not come back, I knew that she had been really strong in getting this task force together, and I wanted to make sure that the connection between the legislature and the task force didn't die. And Rep. Taylor had not exactly run for office yet, and so I stepped in to be that conduit, do it, and fortunate to have Rep. Taylor get elected and want to sit on the task force with us. It's a broad-based task force with Department of Justice, Department of Human Services, the federal prosecutor, and many others that work with us on the task force. So we're trying to do some good work, and every session I think you'll see some bills from our work group around trafficking. This session we tended to focus a little more on child sex trafficking, and so that's the bills that Rep. Taylor mentioned that you'll have coming your way, but thank you for hearing the bills. Appreciate it.
You bet. Questions for the representatives? Thank y'all very much for coming.
We're off to
forward.
Ed Sub. Thank you.
You bet.
Thank you.
Listen, I have on the list Laura Rowland and and Joel Shapiro. Why don't y'all two come forward? While they're coming up, is there going to be anyone else who will want to testify on House Bill 2206? Okay. Whatever order you'd like to go.
Okay. Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, my name is Laura Rowan, and I work for the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. I'm currently a prosecutor assigned to our human trafficking team. As a member of that team, we work with victims of sex trafficking, as well as we charge the crime patronizing a prostitute. I'm here in support of passing the bill with the language that changes that crime to commercial sexual solicitation, because as Representative Taylor just mentioned, a lot of times we see young girls who are either high school students at Madison High School on 82nd Avenue or college students at the PCC campus on 82nd Avenue, which is historically a place where a lot of street-level prostitution takes place. A lot of buyers will solicit these girls. They aren't engaging in prostitution, but they're being solicited nonetheless, and the charge that is appropriate is attempted patronizing a prostitute. That unfairly labels these women who are not engaged in prostitution, as well as the women who are engaged in prostitution are oftentimes victims of sex trafficking. We recently had a case in our county where there was a nurse, a male nurse, who was sexually assaulting patients. One of the patients, he was trading pain meds, pain pills, for sexual favors. The charge that was applicable in that case was patronizing a prostitute. So just another example of a woman who was addicted to pain pills and was taken advantage of. And instead of condoning his behavior by labeling him as something, she was the one who was labeled as a prostitute. So because of that unfair labeling that this current charge implies about the other half of the parties engaged in whatever the conduct is that's charged, we'd ask that you support this language change to commercial sexual solicitation as it better fits the description of the conduct being described. And I'm available for any questions you may have.
Joel?
Thank you very much. I'm Joel Shapiro. I represent Shared Hope International and a number of other nonprofits that work on the issue of child sex trafficking. And I want to thank Chair Przanski and the members of the committee for hearing this bill. It's an important topic in Oregon. We're not going to have a, you know, full-blown go through all the data and efforts and all that. But I will reiterate what Representatives Huffman and Taylor said, that this bill is one of a number that comes from a work group that Representative Tomei brought together during the last legislative session. We started, excuse me, meeting during that session and throughout the interim to discuss ways to improve this issue. And one of the things that was accomplished has been the creation of a statewide shelter to help victims of trafficking who are minors. And we have continued to build out from that effort. There is another bill that's in Ways and Means right now that would create a statewide advisory committee and allow for funding to better address this issue. Having said that, this bill is important for the reasons that others have said, that the language does matter. When you talk about people who are forced into human trafficking and forced to engage in sexual contact for money, that is not a willful choice for most of the people that are participating in that. The word prostitution has the connotation of a willful act, and it really reinforces a lot of cultural narratives and stereotypes about prostitution that do not apply to victims of human trafficking. And so children in the state of Oregon cannot even consent to sexual contact under the laws of Oregon. And when you're engaging in an activity that you can't even consent to, that's not prostitution. And you know, we could certainly have a much longer discussion about that. I know that you have a lot of other bills, and so I'll just leave it at that and be available for questions if there's any follow-up.
All right, any questions? All right, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing, open a work session on House Bill 2206.
Mr. Chairman, House Bill 2206 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2206 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? So ordered. Senator Gelser, would you like to carry this one? Senator Gelser will be the carrier on 2206. We'll close the work session, and we're going to drop down because we have another representative here. This is number three out of the nine that we have. Is that right? Okay. So we're going to open up House Bill 2628A, and this is an inside joke you missed in the morning, so thank you for being here.
And Chair Przanski, members of the committee, House Bill 2628A comes to us from Representatives Leininger and Senator Gelser. The bill disallows all filing fees, service fees, and hearing fees in an action for a court stalking protective order, even if additional relief is sought. It declares an emergency and is effective on passage. There's a minimal fiscal and no revenue. This passed out of the House Judiciary Committee with a unanimous vote and also the floor with a unanimous vote.
All right.
Mr. Chair, she looks familiar. I've seen her somewhere.
Thank you, and good morning, colleagues. I'm Ann Leininger from House District 38. I sort of feel like I should start talking about marijuana, looking at this body of people who serve on that committee. Wonderful to see you all in this other context. House Bill 2628 will help make sure that no one is prevented from getting a protective order to stop someone from stalking them because they don't have the money to pay for filing fees. Every year, about 2,100 Oregonians experience stalking, and a small fraction of that number, about 4 a year, seek a stalking protective order in conjunction with some other relief. It could be damages, it could be a requirement that the stalker stay away from children or pets as well. And under current law, courts are not prevented from charging filing fees when someone seeks a stalking protective order in conjunction with that other related relief. This bill would change that. It would have a de minimis fiscal impact because, of course, there are a very small number of those cases a year. It would be less than about $2,000 a biennium. So I think it may have either a de minimis fiscal or no fiscal at all. But one of the things that it would do is, you know, make sure that no one's deprived of a stalking protective order because they lack resources to pay filing fees. Another crucial thing it would do is stop us from being in violation of the Federal Violence Against Women Act, which has a provision preventing a requirement to pay for filing fees for that kind of relief. And as it is right now, we have placed ourselves in jeopardy of not being eligible for some grants that we get. And a case in point that occurred in Multnomah County is Maureen McKnight submitted for the record. It may be on OLIS in your meeting materials now. It was for us that that Multnomah County was eligible for, was going to get a $400,000 grant to help implement work to protect women under the Violence Against Women Act. And when it came out that they had this protective order, or that they had this filing fee, there was some chance they weren't going to be able to get the grant after all. So this bill does two important things. It makes sure that no one's deprived relief because they can't pay those filing fees, and it makes sure that Oregon does not lose eligibility for important federal grants that we get under the Federal Violence Against Women Act because we're not in compliance with those rules. So I urge your support and a do pass recommendation to the floor. Thanks.
All right. Thank you. Questions for... All right, thank you. Sybil, should I ask you to come up? Why don't you please come on up? And thank you very much
for
the testimony.
Thank you. And thank you to Senator Gelser, who's been a tremendous champion on women's issues and safety issues all session. So thank you.
And while Sybil's getting ready, is there going to be anyone else who wants to testify on House Bill 2628A? Sybil?
Thank you, Chair Prasansky, members of the committee. Sybil Hebb with the Oregon Law Center here, also in support of 2628A. And the representative laid out the great foundation for why we need this bill, and we agree with those comments. The only thing I would add is, from the Law Center's perspective, we've been working on protection order protection order issues for some time, and they're very important to the safety of our clients. For a broader perspective, let you know that filing fees are prohibited in restraining order actions, in Elder Abuse Prevention Act actions, and in most stalking protection order actions. There's just one portion of the statute in 30.866 sub 4, which is the provision that allows the addition of economic damages claims to a stalking statute. Those don't happen very often at all. From 2008 to 2013, as the representative mentioned, there are only 4 filed statewide per year that included that claim of relief, so there is very little fiscal impact to the state if we get rid of that filing fee. And if we don't do this, the courts are prohibited from waiving the filing fee in that particular provision. And so that's why we got into the concern when we were applying for federal grants. Our eligibility was at risk because there was no way for us to waive that fee under the current statute. And I would point out that those federal grants are no match grants generally. They're dollars that come straight into the district attorney's offices. They go to the courts, they go to law enforcement agencies, and also to victim services providers. And so all of those would be at risk if we don't pass the bill. So we really appreciate your support and help, hope that you will move forward. Thank you.
All right, thank you. Any questions? Not seeing any. Okay, we're going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2628A. We'll wait on the vote since we've got two members that are stepped outside for now. Let's go ahead and we'll go back to the top of the agenda, and we'll go to House Bill 2326. And Jeff?
Say that is Eric.
Excuse me, Eric.
Chair Przanski, members of the committee, House Bill 2326 comes from the House Interim Judiciary Committee. The bill amends the conditional discharge statute in light of an appellate case, State versus Granberry. The bill authorizes continued jurisdiction over a defendant in a conditional discharge agreement until final disposition occurs and prohibits dismissal of the offense until the probation terms have been satisfied. The bill declares that an emergency is effective upon passage. There's no revenue impact. There is a fiscal impact statement. It passed out of the House 59-0.
All right. And on this one here, we have Rob is here, and Gail. Both of y'all come on up. While they're coming up, is there anyone else who will want to testify on House Bill 2326? Thank y'all very much, whoever would like to start.
Good morning, Chair Przanski, members of the committee. For the record, Rob Ovette, Legal Counsel Association of Oregon Counties. As counsel mentioned, this is a technical fix to correct a problem created by the State v. Granberry case. But let me briefly explain for those who are not familiar with the conditional discharge statute what it is and what it does and how this affects it. So in Oregon, we allow low-level drug offenders, first-time drug offenders, as well as first-time property offenders, or even in some cases repeat offenders who haven't been afforded this opportunity, the ability to earn dismissal of the case, avoid a conviction by getting evaluated and going through treatment. Mechanically, the way it works is someone comes in based on a plea offer, pleads guilty to the charge. The court doesn't sentence them, however, sets sentencing out for generally just short of a year. And if the person does what they need to do, complies, gets the evaluation, whatever treatment's necessary, when they show up for sentencing, the court dismisses the case, no conviction. If they fail to do it, they fail to comply, the court can either sentence them or give them more time. We've been working really hard over the past two decades to expand and encourage the use of conditional discharge CDs. So I've been working on legislation literally for 20 years to expand it out. It started with certain limited drug crimes. We expanded it to property crimes. We expanded it to frequent and expanded it to misdemeanor crimes. Keep it expanding it. Here's the issue in State v. Granberry. So what if a person enters into a conditional discharge, doesn't comply with the terms of the conditional discharge, doesn't show up for sentencing, and for some mistake in the system, the docketing system doesn't catch it and probation expires? Then State v. Granberry tells you you have to dismiss the case in spite of the fact that the person didn't earn the dismissal. So what this amounts to is a brand new disincentive to offering conditional discharges in the first place. And that's a disincentive we have to get rid of, because we need to be encouraging and expanding the use of CDs, not discouraging them. So what this bill does is it basically says, under those types of circumstances, the court should not dismiss the case, should do a show cause instead, bring the person in, and then at that point in time decide whether or not to give them more time or sentence them. And that's the basic gist of the bill, and would it encourage your strong support of House Bill 2326 to maintain the integrity of this very important functioning statute. It comes to you with no opposition from the House Judiciary Committee and no opposition on the House floor.
Gail?
Thank you. Chair Przanski and members of the committee, Gail Meyer on behalf of the Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We definitely agree that encouraging and promoting the use of conditional discharge is a good thing for the system, and our clients are well served by that process. The only thing I was mentioning, and I asked Mr. Bovette about it, there's no time limit here, so I worry about those cases where the matter isn't caught for a good 5, 6, 7, 8 years out down the road. And right now, the bill as structured would require the court, it says shall not dismiss, but would require the court to continue the probation. And I question whether or not one of the optional remedies that a court might consider is
a discharge in the interest of justice. Right now, as the bill is phrased, it wouldn't allow for any option of that. It would only be for an adjudication of guilt or for continuation of probation. It could be that the defendant had completed 9 out of 10 requirements of the probation, but not all of them. And I don't know but that a court might, in the interest of passage of time, come up with a different remedy than the two that are articulated in the bill right now. But in general, we think it's a good idea to remove any disincentive from district attorneys from offering this conditional discharge in the future. So.
All right, questions? I've got a couple. So, Rob, let's walk through the part of where the person doesn't show up for sentencing, and let's say there's a month left on that 1 year period. Normally, I would expect if it was caught, the court or the prosecutor would basically issue a show cause to keep them going. Once the show cause is issued, I would assume it tolls the probation from expiring because there's this pending action or litigation still to be addressed.
Mr. Chair, you're exactly correct. So under normal circumstances, if a person fails to comply, fails to show up for sentencing, the prosecutor files a motion for revocation of probation, a warrant's issued, and then just the warrant hangs out until they're picked up. So really, the focus of this bill is incredibly narrow.
All right.
You have to have the confluence of failure to comply, failure to appear, and some sort of docketing or other error that doesn't cause a flagged issue. So we're talking about, overall in the state of Oregon, 2,300 CDs a year. I would be stunned if we're talking about more than a handful of cases each year that could fall within this narrow exception.
Now, I agree with that. So the mechanics is what I want to work through, is that if there is that, let's say, chink that's not caught. I understand currently under the case law, it says that if that once that year comes and goes, that there's been no pending action in the sense of the motion for revocation, a show cause, then the court is required to go ahead and dismiss. So if the mechanism now will be that there will take an affirmative action of the court to before the case is automatically dismissed. I'm just trying to make certain I understand for the record exactly what's going to happen with that.
Mr. Chair, it could come up in a number of ways. The person could affirmatively want to clear this off their record and say, okay, I messed up, I want more time, and essentially initiate something to get before the court. It could be the district attorney that initiates something to get something before the court, or it could be the court docketing system itself saying, we've got this aging file that's a year old, and we track all these files. It's an aging file, it's a year too old. We skipped it, we've got to do something, and the court could generate the show cause itself. So I could see that happening under any one of three common scenarios. There might be more that I'm not thinking of.
Okay.
To bring it back before the court.
All right, I'm not familiar with the case that you refer to, but I'm wondering if the court would say that once that year has passed, if there's been no action, that, I mean, I'm just trying to figure out if we're going to be able to have that stay in the sense of not having formality of a conclusion without something that denotes that if there's been this failure to appear and it wasn't caught by the court, that's the exception. Now, maybe this is how the drafting of the bill, I have not looked at it close enough to focus on that.
And, Mr. Chair, I guess I'm not exactly understanding the hypothetical you're presenting. Once we
get beyond the year,
right,
and at that point, my understanding is that they were placed on probation for a year.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. Generally, they're placed on for probation for a year, and there's a sentencing generally set short of that.
Right. All right. So that comes and passes, and then the year passes. That case is just sitting there. It's not automatically, through the court decision, considered dismissed. It still takes an affirmative action of the court to dismiss the case based on nothing happening or the probation running and there wasn't anything tolling the proceeding through a motion to revoke or show cause?
That is correct, Mr. Chair. So that case just sits there on the shelf until the court's own internal tracking mechanism calls the case back up for some final disposition. And then if at that point it goes to a judge, the judge has no choice but to dismiss it under Granberry.
Okay. All right. So basically, based on Granberry,
When that person does show up, it's kind of like, okay, my time's passed. You didn't take care of this, and so just dismiss.
I get a free pass because you didn't catch me.
Okay. And then, Gail, your thinking as to you don't think that the court could take other things in consideration. And my understanding is, let's say, if they come in on time for their hearing as to determining whether they've done everything they're supposed to, if they've done 99% of what they were scheduled to do, that 1% would keep the court from being able to, in the interest of justice, to just say, no, you still got 1% to do?
Chair Pozlansky, yes. I mean, suppose it's in arrears of paying a fine and the defendant is before the court and says, I can pay it right now. As the bill is phrased, the court would have be empowered to do two things. One is either impose an adjudication of guilt and proceed to sentencing, or put the defendant on new terms of probation. And I'm just wondering if there shouldn't be an additional clause in there. The court can have other remedies, you know, as according to justice or whatever.
My practice, I see where defendants come in and their attorney says, my client can now pay.
Right.
And I'm sitting there and the judge says, have they paid? They go out to the counter, pay, and they come back in and it's gone. So I'm just trying to see if it seems to me they already have that power, inherent power.
And Mr. Chair, I would agree with you, and nothing about this bill changes that. And in fact, if it did change it and they had to apply under paragraph A, they could order an extension of probation for 1 hour, allow the person to pay, and then dismiss the case. I mean, but I don't read the bill that way. So I just simply disagree with the concern expressed by Ms. Meyer.
So, Gail?
Chair Pozlansky, I think clarifying this on the record is helpful, that the court could fashion whatever remedies make sense other than necessarily imposing a new term of probation. If you could swiftly resolve the issues of the incomplete, the lack of failure to perform all of the conditions of the original order.
All right. The chair is ready to move forward. Okay. If y'all are okay, then I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing. Maybe this has been good discourse having it on the record, but it seems like those reliefs are already there, built in. So we're going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2326 and open up a work session on House Bill 2326.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2326 to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2326 to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. Any objections? So ordered. The chair will carry 2326 to the floor. We'll close the work session on 2326, and we're going to open up a work session on 2628A. This is the one that we had just regarding the fees being paid or being required on the stalking orders, and I want to go ahead and get all of our members back before we vote it. So, okay. Senator Cruz.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2628A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2628A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussions? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Thatcher, will you be carry on this one?
We do.
All right, Senator Thatcher will be our carry on 2628A.
Mr. Chair, it's actually my bill. Would it be okay if
Oh, no, I have no problem. That's not there. I just heard that they're giving you an acknowledgement. So if it's your bill, if that's all right.
Okay.
Yeah. All right, Senator Gelser will be our carrier on 2628A. Close the work session. Hopefully I'm not in hot water yet. And we'll go to House Bill 2336A.
Chair Pozlansky, members of the committee, House Bill 2336A is also from the Interim Committee on Judiciary. The bill modifies the notice of appeal provisions in Oregon law so that you could file your notice of appeal and serve it by commercial delivery services such as FedEx and UPS. Currently, you are limited to the United States postal system. There is no revenue impact, a minimal fiscal impact, and it is passed out of the House 590.
All right, and we have Jordan Silk. Jordan, why don't you please come forward. As he's coming forward, is there anyone else who will want to testify on House Bill 2336A?
Chair Pozlansky, members of the committee, thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today.
My name is Jordan Silk. I'm an attorney at Schwabe, Williamson & Wyatt in Portland, where I devote a significant portion of my practice to appellate litigation. I'm here today on behalf of the Oregon State Bar's Appellate Practice Section to testify in support of House Bill 2336. House Bill 2336 amends ORS 19260, which, as Mr. Dietrich mentioned, deals with the filing and service of notices of appeal and other, quote, initiating documents in appellate litigation. 19260 has a rule that allows the filing party to use the date of mailing, so the date that they actually put the document in the mailbox, as their official filing and service date for purposes of the time limitations on filing and service. But as it's currently written, they can only use that rule if they send the notice of appeal or other document through the United States Postal Service. HB 2336 amends that rule to bring third-party commercial carriers like UPS and FedEx into the mix, and in doing that makes 19260 consistent with the Oregon Rules of Appellate Procedure, which allow the same kind of use of the mailing date for the filing of other appellate documents like briefs. This is an important issue because the Oregon Court of Appeals has only statutory jurisdiction, and the 30 days in which to file and serve a notice of appeal is jurisdictional. So if somebody misses that deadline or can't use the mailing date and the document doesn't actually get to the court until, you know, a day or two after the deadline, the Court of Appeals actually has lost all jurisdiction over that appeal, and the litigant has lost their appellate rights forever. Unlike the federal courts, the Oregon courts don't have the ability to forgive late filed notices of appeal, regardless of the circumstances that caused the late filing. Additionally, a related concern is that given the regularity that practitioners use third-party commercial carriers to file and serve other documents in the course of their practice, the inability to use those same carriers with respect to this narrow set of documents is a malpractice trap for lawyers. So HB 2336 is a simple amendment that prevents the loss, significant prejudice in the loss of appellate rights based on technical defects, and also fixes a malpractice trap for unwary practitioners that don't realize that they need to treat these documents differently when they file and serve them. I'd urge you all to pass House Bill 2336, and I'm happy to answer any questions that the committee may have.
Jordan, thank you. Any questions? Okay. Thank you very much. We'll go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2336A and open up a work session on House Bill 2336A.
Can I move House Bill 2336A to the floor with a due pass recommendation?
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2336A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Thatcher, will you carry this one?
I'll do this one, okay. Sure.
All right. Anyone else want it? All right, we'll sorry close the work session on House Bill 2336A. Open up a public hearing on House Bill 2385A.
Chair Pazansky and members of the committee, House Bill 2385A comes to us from the Attorney General. The bill clarifies that a person commits the crime of luring a minor and purchasing sex with a minor if the victim is a police officer or a police officer agent posing as a minor. There is a minimal fiscal impact and no revenue impact, and came out of the committee and the floor on the House side with both unanimous votes.
All right, thank you. And let's see, we have here today, I have three individuals. Laura, why don't you come back up, and Michael Sullivan and Joel, if you all would please come forward. While they're coming up, will there be anyone else who'd like to testify today on 2385A? Whoever would like to get started.
Okay. Chair Pazansky, members of the committee, my name is Michael Slosson. I'm an assistant attorney general at the Department of Justice. My current assignment is as special counsel on public safety to the attorney general. I'm here to testify in support of House Bill 2385A. I'm going to focus my testimony on the technical modification to the luring a minor statute. Originally acted in 2007, the purpose of that statute was to criminalize grooming techniques employed by child predators against child victims. the purpose of the grooming technique is to lower a child's inhibitions to sexual contact. So, for example, the luring a minor statute prohibits providing sexual explicit materials to a child to lower the child's inhibitions and to get the child to engage in sexual conduct. And additionally, in an issue here in this particular statute, the legislature recognized that law enforcement was taking a fairly proactive approach to try to prevent the abuse from happening, and so included a provision in the statute that it's no defense that the victim was not actually a minor but a law enforcement officer posing as a minor. Unfortunately, there's one trial court that found that provision is essentially a nullity because of the way the statute is currently drafted. The state still has to prove as an element of the crime that the victim is actually a minor. So what House Bill 2385 does is just make a technical modification to the statute to clarify this legislature's original intent that the crime can be committed against a minor or a police officer posing as a minor or an agent acting on behalf of the officer. There's also now an amendment to the purchasing sex with a minor statute, and I will turn that over to my colleague from Multnomah County to talk about.
Again, Laura Rowan from the Multnomah County District Attorney's Office. So those technical fixes to luring a minor statute now would apply to the purchasing sex with a minor statute, which currently does not include an exception for law enforcement posing as a minor. What we're finding is there are many posts on Backpage.com or Craigslist.com that are pretty brazen in the fact that they're targeting children. And law enforcement is taking the same proactive approach by responding to these advertisements and oftentimes arranging deals with people who are trying to purchase sex with children. Under the current statute of purchasing sex with a minor, because there's no exception for law enforcement posing as a minor, that behavior would only be an attempted purchasing sex with a minor, which would drop it down from a Class C felony to a Class A misdemeanor. That seems to be incongruous with the other charges that we would typically charge for that kind of conduct, which would include luring a minor and also, on occasion, online sexual corruption of a child. Both of those statutes, which generally capture similar behavior, online or text message communications between a person who believes they're communicating with a minor that includes sexual explicit content and also seeks out sexual contact with a minor, both include exceptions for law enforcement posing as a minor, but purchasing sex with a minor is different from those two other crimes that I just described. So this bill would include purchasing sex with a minor on the same crime classification as those other two that I just described, and also would include the technical fix that Michael already described that was currently present in the luring minor. So it mirrors that language, so that technical fix will be made. And for those reasons, we'd ask that you pass 2385A.
Thank you. Joel?
And I'm Joel Shapiro, again, on behalf of Shared Hope. I also want to address the aspect of purchasing sex with a minor and allowing a police officer engaged in that type of an investigation that to also constitute the same crime. This is very important because one of the major efforts within the anti-sex trafficking of children community or effort is to focus the attention on the demand side of the equation. And so purchasers who are specifically seeking children are a very important component of the problem of children being recruited into sex trafficking. If there's not the demand for those people seeking that kind of interaction, that commercial sexual exploitation, then more victims are going to be safe and protected if there's not as high a demand. So we really support the efforts of law enforcement to go after those predators who are specifically seeking children online. And as Laura just testified, that is becoming more and more common, more and more brazen. If you go on to the types of websites where this activity is taking place on Backpage.com, on Craigslist, on other places, TNA board, you can see purchasers who are specifically looking for children, and sometimes even specifically under a certain age where they'll say, you know, I want someone who's 12 or I want someone who's 8. This is just what is going on out there. So if a police officer is able to intervene and intercept that kind of a purchaser, that kind of activity, it's very important that they be held accountable, and there shouldn't be a distinction between whether they happen to actually find a real child or they get caught by law enforcement doing their job.
All right, thank you. Questions? Thank you all very much for coming forward. I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing on House Bill 2385A and open up a work session on House Bill 2385A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2385A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz moves House Bill 2385A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objections? So ordered. Chair is going to carry 2385A to the floor. And we'll close the work session on that bill, and we'll open up our public hearing on House Bill 2420A.
Chair Prezanski, members of the committee, House Bill 2420A comes to this committee at the request of the governor for the Oregon Health Authority. The bill focuses on the issue of when a criminal defendant, for reasons of mental disease or defect, is unable to aid and assist in their own defense. Specifically, the bill requires that a consultation occur between the community mental health director and the defendant when the court has reason to doubt the defendant's fitness to proceed. It requires the director to provide findings to the court regarding community-based restoration before the defendant can be committed to the state hospital. There's no revenue impact, minimal fiscal impact. It passed the House 59-0.
All right, thank you. We have a number of people who would like to testify on 2420A, so let's see. Why don't we first start off with Michael Morris and Cheryl Ramirez. And it looks like maybe Stacy Michelson might be also with Cheryl's group. So why don't y'all three come up.
Chair Prezanski and members of the committee, my name is Michael Morris, and I'm the Behavioral Health Policy Administrator for Addictions and Mental Health within the Oregon Health Authority. And I thank you for the opportunity to testify in support of House Bill 2420. So just to let you know what brought this bill forward is that when an individual is unable to aid and assist in their own defense due to a mental illness, the court has the option of sending that individual to the state hospital for restoration services. And what we have seen recently is that the numbers of those individuals going to the state hospital has continued to climb over the last three or four years, and to the point where we're having to make decisions regarding holding off other admissions of individuals so that we can admit individuals who are unable to aid and assist. And as a result of that, we have individuals who are residing in acute care hospitals under a civil commitment, waiting to get into the state hospital, and due to our pressure with the aid and assist population, we're not able to admit them as quickly as we would like, and the numbers of individuals waiting in acute care hospital has grown in recent months. Currently, we have around 26 individuals waiting in acute care under civil commitment, waiting to get into the state hospital. This causes a backlog in our emergency departments because individuals can't access acute care beds for psychiatric reasons. So that's one of the pressures and one of the issues. The growth in the census of the aid and assist population at the state hospital has grown 70% within just the last 3 years. And so that is what this bill enables the courts to do, or requires the courts to do, is that they engage the community mental health program prior to making a decision to sending an individual to the state hospital. Approximately 40% of the individuals who go to the state hospital under an aid and assist order are for misdemeanors, and we believe that many of those folks, if not most of those folks, could be served in the community with restoration services as well as mental health services. So This requires that the courts check with the mental health programs prior to making that decision to sending individuals to the state hospital. Even our counties that have robust services and are able to provide those restoration services in the communities are reporting that they aren't unaware of individuals going to the state hospital after they're already at the state hospital and there's not an opportunity to intervene and provide the services in the community. Not only is it a pressure on the state hospital, but it is also not the right thing for individuals who don't need the state hospital level of care to end up having to go to the state hospital. It removes them from their community. In some cases, they lose their housing because they're in the state hospital over a month and they are unable to continue rent in their place. They're losing, oftentimes, those who have pets, lose custody of their pets due to extended stay in a state hospital and just removes them from their supports in the community. So we encourage that you pass this with a due pass to the floor, and I thank you for the opportunity to testify this morning.
Thank you. Cheryl?
Good morning. My name is Cheryl Ramirez. I'm the director of the Association of Oregon Community Mental Health Programs, and I'm here on behalf of the 32 community mental health programs across the state of Oregon to enthusiastically support House Bill 2420. We strongly agree with the direction of consultation with community mental health programs before sending 370 clients up to the state hospital so that they may be able to receive restoration services in the community as appropriate. We know that communities that have improved communication and collaboration between the mental health and criminal justice systems have proven effective in decreasing the number of 370 clients that they send to the state hospital. So this seems like good system policy to us. And then last, while potentially diverting up to 57% of the aid and assist clients to the state hospital with the four counties, that's a great dent in bending the cost curve. We hope in the future that there is a systematic distribution of resources so every community has the opportunity to provide restoration services for people to try to keep them in their communities. Thank you for the opportunity to express my support for 2420.
All right, thank you. Stacy?
Chair Brzezinski, members of the committee, for the record, I'm Stacy Michelson, policy manager with the Association of Oregon Counties, also here in support of House Bill 2420. As many of you know, the nexus and partnership between public safety and mental health has been a priority for AOC this session. This bill is very well aligned with what we're hoping to accomplish in terms of serving our folks in the community when there is a mental health situation going on that's resulting in someone becoming justice involved. Also aware, I wore a different hat not too long ago and worked very closely on state hospital issues, and would echo Mike's comments that the 370 population is growing at an incredibly unsustainable rate, and so anything that we can do to curb that growth there is going to result in cost savings in terms of our mental health budget. It's cheaper to serve folks in the community. It's better for them. Enthusiastically support this bill, and also echo Cheryl's comments that this is something that needs to be accessible in all communities, all counties. And while the $4 million pop that will be allocated to the four counties that send folks, at the highest rate, is a big help and a step in the right direction, additional support is needed in all of our communities to make sure that we're serving folks locally and avoiding the cost and trauma of sending folks to the state hospital. Thank you.
Questions? Senator Thatcher.
Okay, so I can understand that maybe serving some of these people in the community might be better for some. And you said most of the people you're talking about were committed misdemeanors, or what would be considered a misdemeanor if they went to court. So if there's a violent streak or tendency, would there be a way to, how does that work out? I mean, some of these facilities in the community aren't exactly secure, and if just because the person needs to be rehabilitated to the point where they can defend themselves, they might still be a danger. How is that dealt with?
Chair Prozanski and Senator Thatcher, in regards to this particular bill and what's in statute, it requires that the court make the determination that the person has the necessary services and supports to safely provide that service in the community. So if someone is considered dangerous and there aren't the secure facilities or the resources to do this in the community, they would go to a state hospital.
Okay. Other questions? Thank you all very much for coming forward. Lisa Nato, Lisa, why don't you come on up? While she's coming up, is there anyone else who will want to testify on House Bill 2420A?
Good morning. I feel like I'm living together with many of the members here tonight because we also have a matter. For the record, my name is Lisa Nato. I'm testifying this morning. I do have a lobbying business, but I'm testifying this morning as an individual. I find it surprisingly difficult and sometimes emotional to testify about personal and family matters, so please bear with me because that is what I intend to do today. The matter before you was mentioned that this involves a 370 population, and I'll just speak to you about one person that entered this 370 population, which was my brother. My background is I'm a former legislator, as many of you know, county commissioner, where I focused a lot of my work on the intersection of mental health and criminal justice. I was chair of the Association of Oregon Public Safety Committee, our local public safety coordinating council, mental health work groups, and the National Association of Counties Public Safety Committee as well. Our intentions in all those different disciplines was to try to, where it can be safely done, take people who are mentally ill out of the criminal justice system and provide services for them. I come from a family of six, four brothers and two sisters, one sister, and there are three. I'm a JD, of course, but as a former prosecutor, and we also have three PhDs. And I'm not telling you that to impress you, but just it's taken the resources and brain power of all our certified smart family to try to help my one brother with severe schizophrenia navigate the criminal justice system, the health system, the federal benefit system, the mental health system. Over 10 years ago, on December 21st in 2010, and I was unaware of this at the time, my brother was in a Fred Meyer store in Tigard. He lives nearby, and he's disheveled, he's overweight. You've seen people like him on the streets. So he would be noticed, and he, and this is not appropriate, it's wrong, he might have been running out of money, but he put a sandwich into his backpack, into his pocket, I think, and put five flashlights into his backpack. He was stopped. He dropped the backpack, went out of the store, and I won't want to make it all pretty. I mean, he said some obscene things, and it was not a pretty sight from the police report. But he fled the scene on his bicycle. Unfortunately, the backpack had an envelope with his address on it, so the police were not too far behind. And when they asked him to stop, well, they would have had no way of knowing that he has no brakes on his bicycle and was not able to stop. But then, and they ended up having to take him down. And he did raise his arm. He says it was to protect himself, but they charged him with a theft two shoplifting charge and a resisting arrest charge. I first found out about this when a couple months later, when, and I could digress a whole bit here, I was in a meeting at AOC on the very issue of building a new facility in Junction City. And the assistant sheriff of Washington County was in the room in that meeting when I got a text message from my sister, who was at my brother's trailer, and saying that the police were there to arrest him. Long story short, they ended up breaking down the trailer door, guns raised. Luckily, she was there to say he has no guns, never has had any weapons, I was able to find out from the assistant sheriff after the meeting that there had been no ambulances called, so everyone was okay. At that point, an attorney is appointed for him. He was in jail for some time. I was able to tell the sheriff that he had mental health background, so they kept him in a and they looked over him, gave him health care services, and also they were able to pull some strings and let me come in to visit him, which is something that most people don't really understand how, just how alone somebody can feel when they don't have the kind of supports that we all have in our lives, and can carry those with us when we're in a different situation. He didn't want to plead guilty to the charge. The district attorney wanted 30 days in jail. He has a long record. It's mostly over 15 years ago. I've looked at the police reports. One of them is a felony, but it involved like under $5 worth of pop cans, and one person said he shoved them, and he maintains to this day that they shoved him first. But nobody believes him, whatever. But that was long ago. And at that point, thank you very much. At that point, the attorney, knew he had these mental health issues, and she wanted an evaluation for both aid and assist. And he does not want to be stigmatized, and he's aware of some of the indeterminate sentences in the mental health system. So he opted for to not take an evaluation. And here's where I made some mistakes. She called me and said she really wanted to evaluate him based on his lack of capacity to form intent on the resisting charge. And I basically talked him into taking the evaluation on that basis. He had the evaluation, and actually to the surprise of our family, thinking it was for that one purpose, and taking him to the evaluation, and he was aware it was to see whether he had formed the right intent to resist arrest. The ruling came, an evaluation came back that he was unable to aid and assist in his defense. And of course, one element to that is that you can trust your attorney and work with your attorney. At that point, we had a hearing. Our whole family submitted letters that he lives on his own, he can navigate in the community with some help from us, and that we really wanted a second opinion or a hearing. That was granted, and some months later, after several delays, my brother went with me. I took him to the state hospital, and he had an outpatient evaluation. And then we went home, and then it was in the summer, July. I was in Idaho and called the attorney. We had a hearing set on a Monday. This was a Thursday. She hadn't gotten the report. So that Monday morning, we went to court. I was thinking it would be set over because we still hadn't seen the evaluation, the second opinion of the state hospital evaluator. And 15 minutes before the hearing, the attorney came in. I said, what was the result? She said, they also found him unable to aid and assist. We were all pretty surprised, and went into the courtroom. The judge, we hadn't seen either of the reports, and there again I made a mistake thinking it was not a public record since the attorney refused to give us a copy of the first report. We went into the courtroom. The judge basically said there are no services in the community in Washington County for us. I would prefer to do that, but I have to order him held into custody, taken to the state hospital. So at that point, my brother had an anxiety attack, collapsed onto the floor, calling, help me, help me. I got up to try to go up, and the judge, of course, had to wave us back and clear the courtroom, and so he was taken into arrest. At that point, I called my ex-husband, who's not a criminal attorney, but I know that one of the elements is trust, and my brother does not want a court-appointed attorney. He thinks they make deals with the district attorney, which they do, and they plead out a lot of cases, and that's the way the system works. So he was sent to the state hospital, and my ex-husband got involved, and he ordered then copies of both of the evaluations. I hadn't realized that the first evaluation was actually a public record from the get-go, because every time I tried to see the file, it had been checked out to the hearing that we were at. And I found out that the attorney had actually asked for the original evaluation to be on an aid and assist, not for the limited purposes of intent for an underlying charge. So for one thing, my brother went into that evaluation not knowing the basis of what they were evaluating, nor was there any preparation for it. And when I looked at the questions that were asked in the evaluation, many of them were based questions about the underlying charge. What did you feel when you were arrested? What did you do in the store? You know, and so it was. I felt it had been a violation of his Fifth Amendment rights against self-incrimination, since that very report had then been filed in the court file. And beyond that, she had misrepresented to me her, at least misrepresented to me the basis for her evaluation. At that point, I filed a bar complaint against her because, and called the state hospital and people and told them basically he had a reason to not trust his attorney in this instance. And I don't know if that's all that went into this, but my ex-husband then filed a motion with the help of my son, who was going to school in the University of Pennsylvania Law School, a very good motion to be substituted as attorney. The court refused that motion because the case was basically on hold because he was unable to aid and assist and therefore ruled incompetent. And even though my ex-husband does not do criminal law, we were willing to support him with, the point was that my brother trusted him as an attorney. And so then Steve Nato, that's my ex-husband, went down to Salem and just decided to represent him as a civil attorney so he could go and see him in the state hospital. I then also learned that the evaluation from the state hospital had recommended that he actually not be treated at the state hospital because he's a paranoid schizophrenic. He doesn't trust institutions, and the potential for him getting even worse was quite high. Luckily, I was able to visit him several times in the state hospital. He was treated quite well. There was an incident where one of his roommates assaulted him, and that's one of the real concerns someone like me has about a brother going to the state hospital or anyone going to the state hospital who's not a dangerous person. There are dangerous people there, and I was very worried that his illness would get worse and that he might never come out of it. Luckily, he was evaluated after the 2 months usually goes by when you're in the state hospital, and I went down to see him about a week before his last evaluation, and I asked him, what are you thinking now about your attorney, since he still had the same attorney? And his response to me was, if I say I don't like her, they'll use that against me. And I figured, well, now you understand what you need to do, to get out of here. They found that he was, I got a call then from the state hospital that he was going to be released back to the jail. And I called my ex-husband, and then he called the attorney, because I know from Multnomah County, somebody can be released on that they're able to aid and assist, but then by the time their hearing comes up, a couple of weeks later, when everybody's ready to have the hearing, they've again decompensated and are again unable to aid and assist, so there can be a kind of a ping pong between the state hospital and the court system. So I called Steve, and then Steve called the attorney, and a hearing was set up for the next morning at 8 a.m. So driving out to Hillsboro to have that hearing, I was actually thinking, well, naively, that the district attorney might be willing to, offer to dismiss the case in the interest of justice, since now my brother had been not only in jail for some period of time, but no, they wanted... their first offer was, and this is before he had come out to Steve, was to say they wanted him to plead to the resisting arrest, which I would have felt like if that was on his record, every time he came up with the police officer, he would be, plus he had just spent 2 months in the state hospital, how were they going to prove intent to resist arrest? So then formal probation, which would have meant our family having to, make sure he gets to his probation, it's kind of a recipe for failure for someone like my brother. In any event, he came into the courtroom. They found that he was able to aid and assist. My ex-husband was appointed to represent him. He pled no contest. The district attorney changed the plea offer. He pled no contest to the shoplifting and was put on bench probation for 2 years, which he has now completed. He was ordered to pay $7 back for the sandwich that was taken. The effect of this on his life, if he had not had a family to pay for his rent on his trailer during the time he was in the state hospital, he would have come out. And nobody asked me, no one from the court, nobody from the hospital, because they turned him over to the jail. He would not have had a home. He would not have had any possessions. His Social Security, he's on disability Social Security funding. He gets a limited amount of funding each month. That goes to him, not us. So we actually make sure he has housing. That was suspended, not because of the hospital, but because he hadn't answered his mail and he hadn't accessed any of his funds. I think they thought he was dead. And at his age, it is surprising that someone with his severe illness is still alive, quite frankly. So that took another whole day to go to the Social Security office, which is another whole complicated thing because he was disabled as a child, so he's under my father's Social Security number, and my father's deceased. And so they're looking at us like we're trying to do some sort of fraud, and finally they got that reinstated. So after the hearing in the House side, Sarah Lochner with the state hospital said some of these people, you know, they lose their pets, and I thought later, well, that happened too. He had a cat that he had rescued. A neighbor lady in a neighbor trailer was taking care of it, but the cat was run over in the time he was in the hospital. There are many people who do not have a family that can try to provide these supports, try to navigate, help them navigate these systems. For those people that are on minor charges, treating in the community, if they have a home, if they have a place to live, is I just can't overstate it to you how important that would be.
Lisa, I have a member that's getting ready to leave.
I'm sorry. So I'm taking way too long.
If you could wrap up, that'd be great.
I would just say at the end of this, we've probably spent as taxpayers at $22,000 a month for the state hospital, well over $60,000 for all of these different elements that were involved when he went to the state hospital and the criminal justice system. In light of the interests of justice, it seems like we can do better. The companion bill to this, which would be the appropriation in ways and means, it would be the most important piece of this to pass as well. Thank you so much for your time. I'm sorry I took so much of your time today.
You're fine. Thank you.
But I appreciate all you're doing.
Thank you. I just wanted to thank you for coming in and telling that story. As you were going through it, a couple of questions that popped into my mind was how long would a non-mentally ill person stay in custody for taking a $7 sandwich? I mean, that just seems like a lot of trauma for a $7 sandwich. The other thing that I was thinking about, last week I had the opportunity to do a four-hour ride-along with the Marion County Sheriff's Mobile Crisis Team. And we visited with a variety of different people, and it was amazing to see the level of support in the community, in their own homes, that just having someone to come and check in when people were having a crisis that they trusted made. These were people that didn't have family members, and each of them talked about, I trust you now, I was having a problem, I need to go to the store, but I'm not feeling well today, I'm afraid I'm going to have an outburst and I'm going to get arrested. And that just seems like a much better investment of resources than what you and your family had to go through.
Absolutely.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
I'm going to go ahead and close the public hearing and open a work session on House Bill 2420A.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2420A to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Cruz is moving House Bill 2420A to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Senator Cruz, you'll be our carrier, please. And with that, we're going to go ahead and close the work session on House Bill 2420A. And colleagues, I believe that takes care of the work for today. Remember, because of our scheduling, we will not be meeting on Monday. This coming Monday.
Was that a present to Senator Burdick?
Yeah, she thought she was going to be off today too, but I said no, you had to work today. With that, we're closed and adjourned.
Just really fast on rounds.
What? I knew we'd find a way to get you last.
What?
I knew we'd find a way to get you last.